Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition. On our program today, is taxing soda a solution to the nationwide problem of obesity? We will look at a measure being considered by California lawmakers. After 22 years, Fresno State President John Welty is retiring. What legacy is he leaving behind, and who will lead the university in the future? And Sweet Fest is back. The unusual way you'll be able to catch these films. But first on Valley Edition, in the past few weeks, the disease known as Valley Fever has gained national attention with a new study from the CDC and an order to remove inmates at high risk of contracting the disease from two Central California prisons. Yesterday, the national broadcast of NPR's Morning Edition featured a piece on Valley Fever by our own Rebecca Plevin. Today on Valley Edition, we learn more about one Central California winemaker featured in that story and how his life has been upended by this sometimes deadly disease.
The quest for the perfect Pinot Noir lured Todd and Tammy Schaefer from Malibu to Paso Robles in 2001.
These big barrels are called puncheons, and they hold about 136 gallons of wine. They used them in the old-time wineries in Europe.
But a different fate awaited them and their business, called Pacific Coast Vineyards.
My wife and I had just come up here to set up shop and continue our practice of winemaking. And welcome to Paso Robles. Here's Valley Fever.
In October of 2003, Todd was running a bulldozer through a vineyard and kicking up lots of dust.
There was nothing in the area to alarm us or have us be aware of that, you know, Valley Fever, it was an epidemic in this area. And so we pursued our dreams, and immediately Todd became infected with the spore.
A few days later, Todd was very sick.
And the doctor said, well, looks like you have influenza, eat some chicken soup, go home, no big deal. All right, I was like, okay, fine. Figured they knew what they're talking about, right? 3 days later, I'm dying. I mean, I'm just in bad shape.
His condition only got worse. A few weeks later, doctors took a lung biopsy and sent it to a lab at UC Davis. When the results came back, the Schaefers learned that Todd had spinal fungal meningitis. Unlike most cases of Valley Fever, which stay in the lungs, Todd's had spread to his spinal fluid.
I'm a big, strong guy, and it knocked me silly. Knocked me flat out. I had no idea what's going on. Valley Fever, what is this disease? It's horrible.
More than a month after he first fell ill, Todd was finally put on antifungal medication. But by that time, his health was wrecked beyond repair.
And it knocked me on my tail. And I couldn't even work. I couldn't get out of bed for how many months? 6 to 8 months? Mm-hmm. So how can you work? I didn't even dream that I'd get out of bed again.
Before Todd got sick, the couple had managed more than 20 vineyards in Malibu. He was a professional volleyball player for several years. But almost 10 years after he contracted the disease, Todd has a sliver of the energy he once had. Today, his health is contingent on a heavy regimen of harsh antifungal drugs.
It's a poison. I mean, it's as simple as that. It's an antifungal poison. It doesn't kill it. It just keeps it down to a low roar, which I don't know how it does that, but thank God it does.
But the drugs are hardly keeping him healthy. When he's up for working, Todd has produced several award-winning wines. But most of the time, he's just too tired.
I feel handicapped, completely handicapped. But I usually come in and get like maybe 4 or 5 hours of work in, and then I am wiped out. I have to go home and take a nap. It's simple as that. And it's getting less and less possible for me to work.
Beyond impacting their business, Tammy says the disease has completely changed her family's life.
It limits everything that you do on a daily basis. You become very fatigued, and then you have, you know, all of the hospital bills and the hospital visits and things like that that become very detrimental to your family. But the biggest thing that Valley Fever, you know, would do with my husband having the disseminated form is it shortens your life expectancy. So everything in your life and your future becomes you know, appropriate on a daily basis, and it becomes more important on a daily basis, the things that you do together.
About a year ago, Todd suffered a small stroke. An infectious disease doctor at Stanford University said he'd developed hydrocephalus, or water on the brain. His doctors expect him to have more strokes and seizures in the future. He's also losing his memory.
I'm becoming more forgetful in my thoughts. I find myself wandering up and down in the house. I forget what I'm doing. I have to write things down all the time. My wife sees it clearly. My son does too, and it's kind of unnerving. It's a little bit much for me.
It could be even worse.
They don't know why I'm alive. My doctors at Stanford look at me, and I've got all the top neurologists and infectious disease doctors, and they say, Todd, we don't understand why and how you are still alive. We don't get it.
Todd doesn't know the answer either, but Tammy credits it to his drive to live.
We think that it's the heart and the passion and the drive of everyday life to battle something that you had no reason, no way of knowing that it was out there or that it could ever affect you.
That passion was evident last Wednesday as Todd walked through the facility where he makes his wine.
Here's a 2012 Pinot, and we're getting ready to bottle the 11 in the next, this month. And I'm really looking forward to this because it smells and tastes so good.
He's also coaching his son's high school volleyball team. He says it's had a healing effect on him.
That's keeping me alive, to tell you the truth. It really is. If I can't coach anymore, that's going to be a hit right there.
Todd hopes his experience sheds light on the need for greater awareness of valley fever and earlier detection of the disease.
I think if they would have caught it early, they would have not allowed it to disseminate through my whole body and eventually rest and set up shop in my brain and spinal cord. That's the killer right there.
Tammy agrees.
It has definitely changed our lives because he was misdiagnosed for so long that he had, the worst case scenario of valley fever.
They hope that with increased awareness of valley fever, other families won't suffer the way they have. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Plevin in Paso Robles.
Thank you, Rebecca, for that report. California lawmakers are considering a measure that would tax sugary drinks a penny per fluid ounce. The proposal is intended to cap soda consumption in order to reduce obesity rates. Healthcare reporter Pauline Bartolone in Sacramento has found a range of options or range of opinions on the soda tax.
It's a hot afternoon in Sacramento's Oak Park neighborhood. Teenagers are out of school for the day. Some have beverages in their hands. Kirk Allen is 16 years old.
What are you drinking?
Tiki Punch, Shasta.
How much was it? Do you remember?
50 cents or $2 for $1.
Allen is exactly the kind of person proponents of the state tax have in mind. He's young and consumes 2 liters of sugary beverages a day. Advocates say taxing sweet teas, sodas, and energy drinks would raise money to fight obesity in young people and make consumers think twice before buying. That's an idea Allen, who's not obese, has mixed feelings on.
I think it's smart, in a way, to prevent some people from buying it, but I know people are still going to buy it if they want it.
His classmates have their own doubts.
They're already taxing us, one on CRV, already for just buying any liquid.
And we already have taxes on beer and, like, cigarettes, so I think we should just leave soda alone.
I mean, it's not that bad just because child obesity isn't a good thing, so. I mean, what's a couple extra cents on a sugary drink, you know?
I also understand and know that
just a few miles away, state lawmakers are having their own debates about the benefits and fairness of taxing sweet drinks. Dr. Harold Goldstein from the California Center for Public Health Advocacy is about to testify at the state capitol to urge lawmakers' support.
You know, it turns out that sugary drinks are the single leading contributor to the obesity epidemic. One 20-ounce soda has 16 teaspoons of sugar.
Goldstein estimates that $1.7 billion would be raised from the penny per ounce tax.
40% of kids in California are overweight, and the beverage tax will raise the money we need for healthier school meals and PE teachers, parks and recs programs in communities, community and school education, nutrition education.
The bill has cleared two committees, but some lawmakers are still unconvinced. They say if we tax sugary drinks, why not tax all products that contain sugar? Others raise concerns about any tax that would single out one industry. Republican State Senator Steve Knight says a main cause of childhood obesity is that kids aren't active outside anymore.
Government has got to understand that we do have choices in this country. When I ate that cheeseburger two nights ago, that probably wasn't the best thing for me to eat. But I did, and I had a choice to eat it. We also had that choice with our children. And I think that the more and more we do this, the more and more we are affecting jobs, we're affecting the choices that we have here in America.
But if you ask a public health expert about the benefits of taxing soda, the answer is clear.
Taxation is one of the most effective and easy policies to prevent the obesity epidemic.
Dr. Laura Schmidt is with the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine. She says there's an irrefutable law in health policy. If you make something less available, you reduce demand.
You can make it more expensive to purchase the product. You can make it harder to get by simply regulating it so that there aren't as many vending machines or there aren't as many corner stores. You can even go down to product placement. You can put it on the top shelf or at the back of the store rather than at the front of the store.
Schmidt says a soda tax would be one way to reduce consumption of an unhealthy product while preserving consumer choice.
Doesn't mean don't ever have it. It means make it a little less abundant in the environment or a little more costly, a little harder to get, and you will see a reduction in the problems associated with consuming that substance.
But Schmidt doesn't see California's soda tax proposal as leading to a significant reduction in soda consumption rates. She says 1 cent per fluid ounce is a very modest tax. Schmidt says to really drive down consumption rates, the price of soda would need to be doubled. Pauline Bartoloni in Sacramento.
Well, this is a story that is being talked about all week long. Fresno State's longest-serving president is retiring after 22 years on the job. President John Welty will participate in his last commencement ceremony this week. Now, as he prepares to say his final goodbyes, many are looking back on what is the legacy of John Welty. They are also thinking about the university's future. As Fresno State looks at new leadership in more than two decades. Joining us now to discuss President Welty's legacy and the university's future is Dr. Pete Mijas, and he is a CSU Board of Trustees and, of course, a longtime superintendent of Fresno County Schools, retired, and also Dean Simpson. He is a private citizen who wrote a letter to the editor, and he is in support of the way the university is handling the search to replace Dr. Welty. I would like to thank both of you for joining us today for this discussion. Mr. Simpson?
Yes, hello.
Okay, just wanted to make sure you were there.
Oh, I'm here.
Well, first of all, I'd like to ask you, Dr. Mijas, is when you look at when you look back at everything that has happened at Fresno State, what do you think President Welty will be remembered for? Because, first of all, we're looking at 22 years here.
That's very unusual for a president to have a tenure of 22 years. The average of a university president is generally about 5 years. Now, when I was fortunate enough to chair the centennial year, I went around the community and I had an opportunity to meet students, faculty, community members. And when you're an institution of 102 years old, which we are now, and when Dr. Welty has been in the leadership role for 20 years or 22 years as well, you're going to make some mistakes. But look at all the positives where Dr. Welty has taken this university. And as we look to his tenure, Has there been some errors? Certainly there has in any leadership role. But overall, I give him very, very high marks in terms of the programs he's established. The Richter Center for Community Service, over 1 million hours of community service the students at Fresno State have given just last year alone. Now, not only does that help the community, but it helps the students in terms of real-life experience and learning. You look at the Schmidt Camp Honors Foundation, students who have gone through millions of dollars where students are able to get honor classes, get their tuition taken care of. These are the kinds of programs, the Lyle School of Entrepreneurship. I can go on and on, the Crimmins School of Education. All of these where Dr. Welty has reached out, raise funds, work with the faculty to provide great opportunities for our students, let alone looking at the facilities. I don't know if people have been out at that campus and looking at the science labs and other things as well. So I give him very high marks for reaching out, not just to the Central Valley, but to all of California, and be able to communicate, to be able to communicate to people what the mission of Fresno State is. So very high marks.
But just in itself, when you take a look at 22 years, as you said, a lot of times, especially in education circles, your superintendents, your presidents, they don't stay very long. What does that say about somebody that, in a way, they've made this their home, their community?
Well, it makes a big difference when someone is vested in the community. I've seen superintendents and presidents who come in and blow out. And they don't have to live sometimes with some of their decisions. The fact that someone stays in the community and you get vetted by your neighbors. When I was superintendent, county superintendent of schools, if I would go down to the market and I made a bad decision, someone would say, "Hey, Mias," and that's healthy. That is really healthy to be able to live with your decisions and their community has interaction with you. So that says a lot not only about Dr. Welty's success, but also about our community, that our community has supported. They've seen – you know, there's an old saying, Juanita, to find a friend, you need to close one eye. To keep a friend, you need to close two eyes. So sometimes my friends, when I was superintendent, sometimes would have to close two eyes when I would fumble the ball on occasion.
You know, Mr. Simpson, I know you wrote about the whole selection process, but I just want to get your opinion as someone who lives here, who's obviously familiar with the university, has seen the university change and grow. And just as someone who lives here, how do you feel about Fresno State?
Well, I think one of the most to me, one of the most terrific things that has happened has been the expansion of some programs, for example, like the winemaking program. Fresno State is the only commercial winery in the United States. And so you've got these students who are learning hands-on. Mm-hmm. How to accomplish something, and there was always a winemaking program, but you know it is just grown and expanded in the last few years to a point where it's really something that of great substance, and I would imagine probably draws a lot of students from a lot of different places.
And it was this whole notion. I can remember. I'm one of those who can remember when Dr. Welty first came. But I remember early on him talking about wanting this to be a regional university, not just Fresno State. And, of course, this was before UC Merced. And it was this whole idea of, to serve the entire valley.
Juanita, you're absolutely right. Dr. Welty has reached out in many, many ways to the north and to the south, making it a regional educational center. And, Dean, you're absolutely correct. That's one of my favorite departments, the Enology Department, the wine department out at Fresno State, because it really does mirror what John Dewey in his school of his theory is you learn by doing. And I know a lot of people go out to the ag farm out there to buy that sweet corn. And one of the things that contributed to a $40 million contribution to the university, that a gentleman and his wife went out there and they saw the entrepreneurship of that ag where kids were producing, selling, learning real-world experiences, impressed this individual so much that he made a $40 million contribution to the university.
And as you stated, you know, you can take a look around at the university and you can see some of the changes. You can see the physical changes that have taken place. University has garnered, you know, an awful lot of attention. But you also have to kind of look at what are some of the challenges that Dr. Welty had to face. And it was in that area of athletics that seemed to just leave that mark.
Well, there's major challenges, and that defines a leader, how a leader navigates through troubled waters. And certainly when the state cuts your budget 37% over 3 years, and Dr. Welty has had to adjust to those tremendous cuts. Clearly, in the area of athletics, and I've told Dr. Welty this, that that's been a little bit of his Achilles heel, because people tend to look at tend to look at an institution, well, how well is their football team doing, or the basketball scandals or whatever. And so Dr. Welty has had to weather that storm of those lawsuits. And so athletics probably has been a real challenge when you're a Division I school, which then speaks to the next president of CSU better have some understanding of NC2A compliance regulations, gender equity in athletics, all of these things. So not only are you, quote, an academic president, not only you're a fundraiser, not only are you a community leader, but you better also understand the implications of NC2A Division I athletics.
Well, let's with Mr. Simpson here, let's just talk a little bit about this whole selection process, because that's what has been in the news. A lot of people feel like it should be an open process. Why do you feel that it's, Dr. Mears, that's not a way you want to go? And then, Mr. Simpson, I'd also like to have your opinion after Dr. Mears. Go ahead.
Well, I'm glad you said, I think the one thing we're all agreement is we want to get the best fit. We want to get the best candidate. As a Board of Trustees member, I've been through five of these presidential search processes. And in 2010, we had some of the best search firms in the country come before us because we wanted to look at our presidential compensation, our process, because we were concerned of the declining number of candidates we were getting of existing presidents. Now, quickly, and Dean, I don't want to take your time on this, but one of the things, there's two things we found out. The least indices, if you can use that term, of a person's ability to effectively lead an organization is not how they interview. That's a small part, not their vita or their bio, but what is their track record? So we need to find out what is that person's track record if he's an existing president of another institution. We can't find that all out if it's open, if it's, quote, if it's an open search. Because a lot of these existing presidents will not apply. And that was what was happening to the CSU system. Because also, we have some disadvantages, and I won't go into that now, as California. When someone looks at California, and the state of California at one time invested in education, whether it's K-12 or higher ed, we have no longer invested. We are no longer the lighthouse of higher education in the country as we once were, as it related to access, that all kids, like many of us who are first-year college graduates or first-year generation to be able to graduate and attend university. So we found out that essentially what is very, very important is to get the best candidate with the best fit. When you do an open search, you substantially reduce the pool of candidates who are going to apply, because a well-seasoned, successful existing president is not going to put his or her career on the line if it's broadcast all over. That being said, it's very important then you have people who vet the candidates who are representative of the community. And that's why, as an old civics teacher, I learned that we are a representative form of government. 70% of the people on the advisory committee that advise to us trustees who go through the process of vetting the candidates, they've been elected by the faculty, they've been elected by the students, they're from the community. They all participate in this process. So the community has input into this process as we go forth, but the ultimate decision will be that with the Board of Trustees. So what I'm simply saying is, our experiences showed us we get the best candidates when we have this confidential search process.
Mr. Simpson, why do you agree with the way this election process is going?
Well, actually, I agree because of secondhand experience. My brother is a dean of the College of Arts and Sciences in a university in the Midwest. And it's what they call a middle-tier university in that they offer some doctoral programs, but it's not like a prestigious research university that offers, you know, doctoral programs and all sorts of things. And they decided on an open search. And they wound up with a very, very shallow pool of candidates. None of them were from a top-tier university. The only candidate that was even with a comparable background as far as experience at a university like the one that my brother teaches at was the internal candidate. All three of the other final four candidates were from smaller schools that offered nothing higher than a master's program. Some of them had their own little baggage that they were carrying, and it was because essentially they had very little to lose. One of them had already been told that his contract was not going to be renewed for the following year. So it told me that essentially what Dr. Mias is saying is correct. You know, if you want to get the best people, if you want to get somebody who's maybe a provost or vice president of academics or something like that from a top-tier university, you're not going to get somebody like that if it is an open process, because you don't want a situation where if it's known that this person is looking for another job, then people are going to start looking for his successor. this person is putting himself or herself in great jeopardy by it becoming public knowledge that that he or she is involved in a job search.
So it's just not that cut and dry, because you have people who are saying, look, this is a public institution, it's a public university, you know, the public should have some input, students should have some input.
Absolutely, so, they should have input. Indeed.
And they do, because of the nature, the composition. I mean, I've read in the newspaper the list of people who are on the search committee, and there are faculty members, there are community members, there are students. Now, maybe it's not top-heavy with students and faculty members and things like that, but I'm not sure that the average faculty member is necessarily knowledgeable enough in the administrative end of a university that a decision would be necessarily qualified.
Well, we are going to continue this discussion after the break with a faculty member and a student from Fresno State. I'm Anita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Kaiser Permanente Fresno.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. I'm Anita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. We are continuing our discussion about the retirement of President John Welty and just what that means for the university, also taking a look at his legacy. Just had a conversation with Dr. Pete Mias, a CSU Board of Trustee member, and Dean Simpson, a local resident. Now joining us is Tom Holyoke, Fresno State Associate Political Science Professor, and Jose Nava, a Fresno State student.
Hello, Juanita.
Hello, both of you. Thanks for coming in. I'd like to get both of your opinions because you, how long have you been a faculty member there now, Tom?
Oh, I think about 8 years now.
Okay. And, you know, a lot of people are taking this time to look back, reflect, before we get into the selection process, because I know both of you have opinions about that as well. But when you take a look back at Dr. Welty, someone who's been here through 22 years, also over was president of the university during one of the worst economic crises this country has seen. We all know about California and the California's there's no other way to sum it up, a budget mess year after year after year where education has often been cut. So he served during this whole time. But when you think about university and Dr. Welty, what do you think his legacy might be for someone like you when you look back?
Well, I think that he has probably quite a number of legacies. And certainly he did lead the university through probably its darkest hours in these last few years with the great budget mess and California essentially de-investing in its higher education system. And you know, to his credit, I think he may even have postponed his retirement in order to see the university through this dark time without handing off this giant mess to a successor.
And as students, because he did spend a lot of time with students, he was engaged with students from what I could recall as a student at Fresno State. What do you think when you look back?
I think he did a good job handling it. He would communicate with us, the students. He was able to you know, lead the university in the right direction during those, you know, hard, you know, economic times. He was always there talking with us. I mean, during 2008 when there was the budget crisis, I mean, a lot of students were out there, you know, voicing their concerns, and he did sit with us at the table. It took us a while, but he did, you know, listen to us.
Do you think there's something to be said for having that kind of longevity in leadership?
It's a little unusual in academia, to be sure, but on the other hand, it means that President Welty was able to really become well-known in the community and to put down deep roots in the community, which allows the opportunity for him and really the entire university to build up a lot of trust and goodwill. And that, too, I think is very much his legacy, the integration of Fresno State much more deeply into this part of the Central Valley.
And the fact that the university looks very different today. I mean, there were a lot of projects, building projects that took place, and also some of the, you know, endowed departments, all coming from the fact that he was a master fundraiser. He raised a lot of money, and I'm sure, you know, depending on your opinion, some people might say, you know, maybe that time could have been spent more like on academic programs. But if you look at the reality of today's university, don't you have to have somebody who can fundraise?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, for better or for worse, and I'm not particularly happy about it, but, you know, absolutely the modern university president has to spend probably the lion's share of his or her time on fundraising. And whoever the new president is will absolutely have to do that as well. So I assume that one of the major qualifications going into the search is a demonstrated fundraising ability.
When we talk about going into the search, I know there has been a lot of opposition raised at how they're going about the search. I'd like to have both of you. We'll start with you, Jose. You know, people's concerns about that, because what I'm looking at, they think of the fact that this is, you know, a public university, a people's university in a way. So
it is a public university. And I mean, students should have a say in the selection process. And we haven't seen that. It's been, you know, a secret process. We know it's going on, but, you know, students can't go out there and voice their concerns, or we can't, you know, ask the candidates questions. And I mean, this is going to be the head of our university. We should know who these candidates are. I mean, when John Welty came in, people in the community were able to ask him questions before he was selected. And you know, we had one open forum, and it was during, you know, when classes are in session. I mean, students weren't able to come in and see what was going on. And no candidates were there as well. So it's kind of, you know, what's going on? It's a public university. Students in the community should have a say because, I mean, this is a
Juanita, we are a public institution, even if the public funding has been declining quite a bit. And, you know, we essentially, as being part of the public sector, all of the decisions are supposed to be made in the public domain. And even though people are appointed or elected to a search committee and the advisory committee, they should not be meeting behind closed doors. You know, the public's business is to be done in public, unless there is a truly overriding reason to go behind closed doors. And I just don't see that this exists at this point.
But what about the argument that we just heard, that it does make this election process difficult if people who are candidates, their names are out there, maybe they're still working at a university or a college, and if their name is put forth, what does that, you know, kind of mean for them? I think there are a lot of people out there who might say, okay, they take a look at their own job search and they might still be working for a company and they don't necessarily want their boss to know that they're looking for another job. So how do you answer those kind of concerns in that I know with the university that you're going to say that's different?
Well, first off, I'm always a little wary of drawing too many parallels with the private sector. We're not a private sector institution. But going beyond that, first off, you know, John Welty himself was chosen through a public search process, and it seems to me that we actually came up with somebody who was pretty good through that search process. Also recently, the CSU, a public search for the president of San Luis Obispo, which I believe went well, and ironically, he is also on the advisory committee. And the Sacramento Bee, I believe yesterday, put out a nice editorializing against the secrecy of the search and listed successful open searches at other public institutions used in other states. So this can be done and is being done successfully as a public process. Now, a lot of us who are talking about this aren't saying that maybe necessarily the entire process should have been opened, but maybe the final three candidates should be brought to Fresno.
And I assume, Jose, you feel the same way about that.
I agree.
At some point, have a chance to see who the final candidates are before the final selection is made. That's what all you all would like to see.
Yeah, we would like to see, you know, them come to campus and have an open forum where we could ask them questions.
How do you think that might impact then the person who does come in, if the fact that you haven't had a chance to discuss issues with him or her, know anything about them until that person is presented to you? What does it kind of put them in a certain kind of position, and as far as how they relate to the students and the faculty?
Yeah, I feel that there's going to be a disconnect because, I mean, students on campus, a lot of them don't know the search is going on, and a lot of students have no say in the search. So a lot of students are going to be like, who is this new president? We've never heard his name. Who is he? So there's going to be this disconnect. Students are going to be just caught off guard. That's who he is.
I would think you need someone to come in who, you know, we have a chance as faculty and students to, you know, say these are our issues, these are our concerns. Let's hear what you have to say about that. To essentially almost, you know, put the candidate on the spot a bit in terms of, you know, how would you react to this sort of thing? Do you support, you know, shared governance of a university you see with the faculty and students? And also, I think it would be good for the candidate themselves to, you know, they're coming from the East Coast to realize that, you know, Fresno is not on the beach.
misconception.
Yeah, I don't think I quite
appreciate
that.
For a lot of job candidates.
You know, this is the community we are. This is the priorities we have. We're not necessarily like the West Coast of California. And, you know, make sure you realize who we are before you accept a job out here.
Let's talk a little bit about, and both of you have agreed that you think highly, despite, you know, some of the challenges, despite some of the controversies that President Welty has, kind of left the university at a good standing point, withstanding the fact that, you know, you still have these budget cuts coming from the state. So this person coming in, what are they going to have to deal with? And what do you want to see in a new president? Let's start with you, Tom.
Certainly the budget issue is still very much there, even with the passage of Prop 30. That just, you know, prevented us from taking yet another cut. I mean, we've been cut badly for years now. And frankly, I don't see that trend really reversing. I mean, a fully funded state institution, fully funded by the state, I don't see that is in the future, and I don't think the governor's May revise today is going to offer us much hope. So we need a president who can do a great deal of fundraising outside of the university. So that's certainly a challenge. And you know, going through these hard times did create some ill will between the administration and the faculty. Threats to dismantle the College of Arts and Humanities, and just some concerns about some of the hiring practices, and these remain. And the new president needs to be able to come in and work with faculty and students to really take care, get rid of that divide.
And as a student,
I feel that when the new president has to be an advocate for higher education, we need someone who's really passionate and someone who's actually gonna stand with the students and listen to our concerns about, the budget cuts. Someone who's going to, be, right by our side when we go up to the Capitol and, lobby. And we need someone who's actually, going to be champion for education.
Well, I guess, we would all agree that the university will continue and is entering challenging times. So let's wish the best for whoever comes in and leads next.
And we do wish the best.
Thank you both
Thank you.
For coming
Thank
in. You. Appreciate Thank it. You. And moving on with Valley Edition. A group with a goal to restore cultural heritage among Valley immigrants will have a showing this weekend. FM 89's Rebecca Plevin interviews one of 10 grassroots immigrant leaders showcased in the No Longer Strangers performance, a collaborative with hopes to give a voice to underreported people groups in the region.
Joining me in the studio is Mirna Martinez with the American Friends Service Committee in the Central Valley and Ba Hyung, a Tamajawi Fellow. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you.
So what does the word Tamajawi mean?
The word Tamajawi is a makeup word that it means the concept is a central outdoor market or cultural market, a place of gathering, a place of people coming together to not only exchange goods but also exchange information, a place where people can communicate. So Tamajawi is a word that is made of three languages. The Talashapong, that is Lao and Hmong, which means market, and M-E, it comes from the Spanish word mercado, which also means a market. And the Yavi comes from the Mixteco, which is an indigenous language from Mexico, from the word Nunyavi, which also means mercado. So we combine all these three languages that have the same meaning. So Tamajawi actually means a cultural market, a place of exchange, place of gathering.
And then what is your role as a Tamajawi Fellow?
The fellowship, they give us, community members, the tools of how to go about to organize our communities culturally and also giving us resources of how to go about doing it. My job is to really start this dialogue of understanding each other's culture and also sharing each other's cultures, building the understanding. And then at the same time, too, it's like through that dialogue and that discussion, learning how to express our culture in an artistic manner in which we could share it with the general public so that they could come and experience what is some of the essence and beauties of our culture. So for me, being from a ethnically Hmong background, what does it mean for the Hmong culture for me, and how do I share that with everyone else here in the Central Valley?
How interesting. And so is there an art project that you're putting on right now or they're getting ready to share?
Yes. Each of us put on an event or a gathering expressing our culture to the public. And so for me, I've already did mine. What I did was I invited community members who are from the different generations, from like you got your teens, your parents, your elders, and also someone who works with the Hmong community but is not considered Hmong, to share their stories and experiences growing up here in the Central Valley, here in Fresno. And I also put up pictures documenting the resettlement process of the Hmong community as we came here to Fresno and the accomplishments that we achieved so far. So all of the fellows have already finished our event, but for the grand finale, it's where we bring all of the fellows and a piece of what we showed and shared during our event and putting it together at one grand finale. For those who may not have had the opportunity to come to each of us individual, they get to experience bits and pieces of what we shared.
You talked about you doing this sharing and learning. What do you think you've learned as a fellow? Is there something that you've really taken away from this experience?
Yes, I learned so much stuff about like me personally, myself, and also connecting with people from other indigenous groups, other ethnic groups, and other immigrants here in the Central Valley. Because like for me personally, I've become so comfortable just being around the Hmong community that it wasn't until I was a part of this fellowship program where I got this opportunity to really experience and learn about other cultures who live here in the Central Valleys and also build those relationships where what are their experiences? What are some of the issues that they're going through and facing? And I get to share some of my experiences. What are some of the issues that I feel that my people, my community are facing? And we really get to learn about what are some of the similarities and some of the differences. For example, like just the loss of like, we feel like a sense of loss of our culture, a sense of loss of our identity, and knowing our roots as to our history, where we came from, because majority of the people who are part of the fellowship program, they are either first generation or second generation. So it's either they weren't born here in the United States or they were the first of their family to be born here in the United States. And to be losing some of the cultural aspect where they feel they've always grew up and held tightly to, it's just, that is what I saw, that one example of the commonalities that we all each share.
Before we continue on, tell me a little bit about your background. So you said you were born here, but where's your, tell me about, a little bit about where your family's from and your childhood here.
Yeah, for my parents are refugees from Laos, and they came here to America in 1986. I was actually the first. I'm the first from my family to be born here in the United States, and there are eight of us total. So I'm the third youngest in my family, and I was born in 1987 in Long Beach, California. And after a year living there in Long Beach, we moved here to the Central Valley here in Fresno, because my grandparents from my mom's side, they lived here, and so we came here following them. And my parents did agriculture work, too, back in Laos, because it was very, we live in a mountainous area, so we pretty much did everything, grew our own food and raised our own animal and crop. And so they were used to that. And so that's one of the advantages of coming here to Fresno. But for me, I'm the first from my family to actually go to graduate from a four-year university. I'm not the first to attend one. I have my older siblings, my brothers and sister, who did attend, but they never finished. But I'm actually the first to finish it at UCLA. And so I graduated in 2010, and now I'm back here in Fresno, connecting with the community, reconnecting with the community. Because growing up, I never was connected with my community. Being, when I say my community, I'm also referring to not just the Hmong community, but the Fresno community, the Central Valley community, and just the community here in the United States.
So turning back to you, Myrna, tell me about the event coming up this weekend.
Well, this is going to be a very exciting event because, like Paul says, it's going to be pieces of different highlights of the nine presentations that already took place throughout the Central Valley, because they were in four cities in the Central Valley. But what we wanted to do is kind of bring all these stories in one story. So we've been it's been great because everybody's producing it together. It's not going to be a theater play or anything. It's going to be more like a multimedia event. And the interesting thing for this event is that we are collaborating with more professional artists. One is we are going to have two dancers for the Urban Bush Women. It's a dance group from New York. Pop, he also does spoken word. So him and another young Latino spoken word artist are collaborating with a a well-known spoken word artist from New Jersey. His name is Adam Shadowcat. So you will have the opportunity to see from traditional musical instruments. We have a group of musicians, Cambodian musicians, that are going to be playing traditional Cambodian instruments. We have a local master musician from Iran, and he plays the classical instruments called santur. So you will see all these, but all connected, actually, pop and the other artists, the other spoken word artists, they are going to be like the connectors of all these different stories.
What do you hope that people will learn either about the Central Valley, about their own community, about other communities when they come to this event?
Well, the way we see this is that this is a very critical moment for people to have a better understanding about who the immigrant communities are. As you know, right now, at this moment, there is a national debate about the immigration reform, you know, and there are a lot of things that have been debated, but many people really don't know who the immigrants are. And like Paul was saying before, he has this opportunity of building relationships with these different groups. He didn't know anything about the presence of all the groups. So what we want for people to understand that the Central Valley is very diverse, but who makes this diversity, you know? And I think that diversity could be a very good thing, but we also have to build relationships and have a better understanding from each other. Because ultimately, we share the same place, we share the same space, and I think that we all have the same vision in a way. But if we don't know each other, we kind of want to start. And the intention of this program has been all along, you know, to break the isolation that exists among the different groups and have the opportunities for these groups that are so underserved, like Pop said, to express their voices, you know, to be better known and by others, but for them also. So that's, I think that people, besides coming to the grand finale, which, by the way, we call No Longer Strangers, they will have not only the opportunity to enjoy all the beautiful and great cultural and artistic expressions of these communities, but really learn about the who we are, who is who here in the Central Valley, who are the immigrants that live here in the Central Valley.
We've been talking with Myrna Martinez and Ba Hyung of the Tamajavi Culture and Art Series, which is holding its grand finale event on Saturday evening at the Tower Theater in Fresno. Well, I thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us for Valley Edition and Valley Public Radio, and it sounds like it's going to be a great event.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rebecca. In an age where top-grossing box office films dominate the big screen, a local festival known as Sweet Fest celebrates the very same films in a new way. A phone with a video camera is all you need. Valley Public Radio's Ezra Romero interviews Sweet Fest organizers Brian Harley and Rocky Rodriguez about how to create your own short film based on your favorite movie of the past or present.
So, what is Sweet Fest?
Sweet Fest is a film festival that we started here in Fresno in 2008 and with the intent of promoting filmmaking here in town. And Sweet Fest is a place where people make their own low-budget Hollywood remakes and using cardboard and creativity, using their friends to shoot, you know, your favorite movie using your cell phone camera. And you send it to us at Sweet Fest, and we showcase it on a movie theater on a big screen with an entire audience.
You were telling me earlier that it started because of Be Kind Rewind.
Yes.
Give me a little history of that and how it's played out over the past 11 years.
Yeah, so in this movie called Be Kind Rewind, came out in 2008, directed by Michel Gondry, French filmmaker. It starred Jack Black and Mos Def. It was a fairly popular movie, but I think it kind of rode under a lot of people's radar. But it basically was these two guys who worked in a video store. And it's an old video store, VHS tapes. So they don't have a lot of customers. And one day they accidentally erase all the tapes. So they figure, oh no, we got to fool like the one or two customers that still come in and rent these things. Let's just remake the movies ourselves really low budget quickly. And in their community, this sort of catches on. People like these remakes that they're doing. And it becomes really popular. And we thought, oh, this movie's pretty fun. We enjoyed it. So why don't we start a film festival kind of around this concept? and just basically do the same thing in our community, make these low-budget remakes, hold an event, have the whole community come out and see what they think. And it started off pretty slow. You know, we got around 30, 40 people that first time, but it's really grown since then, to our surprise, really. And we do it twice a year, and I think this is the fifth year. It's our 11th one. And the 10th one, we brought out 500 people to the Tower Theater. So it's pretty crazy how it's grown.
Yeah, it's been growing pretty steadily with the first one. And now, you know, we're at the big giant. We started an art studio, art gallery in downtown Fresno. And now we're at the Tower Theater and we're packing it out. It's pretty awesome to see how much it's grown in the short amount of time.
Wow. Can you give me an example of a suited film?
Well, we've had plenty. We've had films from like Citizen Kane been suited to like more recent contemporary films like The Avengers and stuff like that. So any movie that's popular can be suited. Not just movies, too. TV shows have been done. There's, you know, it's kind of open to a bunch of different media. So, but movies is the primary kind of format that people go to gravitate towards. So we've had, you know, all kinds of movies, science fiction, dramas, comedies have been done for a Sweet Fest. So it's a pretty wide range of films that we've gone for our festival.
I mean, anything can be sweeted. Yeah. So all sweeting is taking something that you like and sort of remaking it in this really low budget way with your friends and family and just having fun because you're a fan of it. So it's kind of mixing in something you like with things that you like and yourself and your personality, and then you get this just hilarious short little remake.
Yeah, Michel Gondry has a real good saying that says, you know, you're going to like this movie because you're in it. So that's the cool thing about the screening at Sweet Fest is you get together with everyone that created the film. You get to see it on the big screen with a wide audience, and you get to hear their reaction to it, and it just elevates the whole experience.
And we make it a point that anyone can swede. This is not just for people who are considered themselves filmmakers or want to make – it's just for anyone who can do it. You grab your cell phone, your home video camera. It's really accessible. You just pick your favorite movie, grab whatever you have lying around the house, and remake the movie.
So who's sweeting? Is it mainly teenagers, college age, or are you getting a various range of people?
It's surprisingly like a wide range of people, from young to old to families to friends to, you know, teenage friends. It's really crazy the wide range of people
yeah.
we get.
We've had a family that submitted, and not only, you know, it was not only their family, but they got like neighbors involved and stuff, and they did Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. They got so many people in the neighborhood kind of involved in shooting this thing. It was a pretty awesome thing to see. And, you know, and they all rolled out for Sweet Fest and to check it out at the Tower Theater last time. And it was cool to see how many people can get involved. And you can make it as complicated as you want if you really want to get detailed in there, or if you want to just keep it simple and just do – we've had a suite as short as like 10 seconds. And, it was hilarious. So, I mean, it's really how much you want to put into it. So, and we the suites are limited to 5 minutes or 4 minutes or less, because we no one wants to sit through a half hour remake of, you know, Citizen Kane. So we keep it down to 4 minutes or less, and it goes rather quickly, and it's really fun.
What's been one of the more popular suites maybe last year, and what are you looking forward to this year?
Let's see. Well, one of my favorites has always been Pulp Fiction from Kevin Searcy, who's a local guy who just submitted out of the blue. Mm-hmm. And they've come back and submitted a lot since then. But you wouldn't think that you could make a family-friendly, sweeted version of Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
But they like replaced the guns with vegetables and stuff, and it was just hilarious.
Yeah. John Rios, who also consistently submits Swedes to the festival, does a really good job. It's always the same group of people, and always good to see these. It's like, you know, you see these people that have been involved in his films, and it's cool to see the faces again. And he does a really good job. They all do a really good job of, you know, they did Kill Bill recently. They just do an awesome job when it comes down to Sweden.
That's what's really fun about it too, is every single Swede Fest you have some new faces who are submitting for the first time, but then there's these guys that have really latched onto the concept and have submitted every single time.
Yeah.
So say I'm going to create something. What do I need and how do I go about it?
Okay, you need a camera of some sort. It could be your cell phone, anything that records video. You need a favorite movie, whatever the movie is. It's better that you like the movie, that it's a personal favorite of yours, because it'll be, you know, more fun to do. Mm-hmm. And then you need friends or family. Really, you don't. You could do it yourself. You could play all the roles
it's
yourself.
It's been done, yeah.
But I guess you would need some props then, whether it's
cardboard.
Something cardboard, you know, you grab out of the dumpster or go to the dollar store and buy some little dollar toys. We don't want people spending tons of money. The lower budget, the better.
Yeah, it's all about creativity. So it's how you solve these problems creatively. How am I going to make this explosion work with, you know, with my 50-cent budget and just having stuff lying around the house? So you draw an explosion on a piece of paper, or you use cellophane, or, you know, there's just multiple ways to kind of problem solve these issues that come up. And it's kind of it comes through, too, when people kind of come up with these solutions for a Hollywood movie that spent hundreds of millions of dollars to create these special effects. And how do you do it at home using just stuff lying around the house? And it's really cool to see that.
And what's great is most everyone in the theater has seen the movie before, so they know exactly what you're going for, and it's just hilarious.
Yeah.
Well, thank you guys for coming in. We're with Brian Harley and Rocky Rodriguez of Sweet Fest. Thanks for coming in. We're looking forward to this to the festival.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Yep.
And thank you, Ezra. That sounds like a fun night. Well, that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can also email us at talk@kvpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, Valley Edition producer Ezra Romero, and executive producer Joe Moore. I'm Juanita Stevenson. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org.